This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
It's no secret that some of the greatest writers the world has known have also been some of the biggest drinkers. But is there a connection between the remarkable creativity of an Ernest Hemingway or John Cheever and the contents of their favorite bottle?
And I found that over and over again with Tennessee Williams, with Hemingway, with Cheever, that they all have this sort of sense of escape, a desire to slip away from the cares of their lives, and alcohol is the key for them to do that. And it works very well in the early stages.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear from author Olivia Lang, who tries to find out if there's a connection between the page and the bottle. We'll also spend an academic minute trying to find out why some things just make you laugh. I'm Bob Barrow, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. In her new book called The Trip to Echo Spring, On Writers and Drinking, Olivia Lang examines the link between creativity and alcohol through the work and lives of six extraordinary men: F. Scott Fitzgerald, Ernest Hemingway, Tennessee Williams, John Berryman, John Cheever, and Raymond Carver. All six of these writers were alcoholics, and the subject of drinking surfaces in some of their finest work, from Cat on a Hot Tin Roof to A Movable Feast. Olivia Lang grew up in an alcoholic family herself. One spring, wanting to make sense of this ferocious, entangling disease, she took a journey across America that plunged her into the heart of these overlapping lives. As she travels from Cheever's New York to Williams' New Orleans, and from Hemingway's Key West to Carver's Port Angeles, she pieces together a topographical map of alcoholism, from the horrors of addiction to the miraculous possibilities of recovery. The Best of Our Knowledge's Joe Donahue spoke with Olivia Lang and asked her to explain the title of her book.
The title comes from Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, actually. It's the drunkard Brick, who's the retired sports hero. He's on crutches, played by Paul Newman in the film. And he keeps getting up and hobbling to the liquor cabinet. And he calls that, he says to his wife, Maggie the Cat, "I'm just making a little short trip to Echo Spring." And he partly means he's just going over to the liquor cabinet to get the bourbon, which is called Echo Spring. But he means something else as well. And it was that sort of mysterious sense of what the drive to drink is. Later in the play, he talks a lot about, "I'm waiting for the click." And his father, Big Daddy, says, "What are you talking about? What's the click?" And he says, that moment when it all just switches off, that moment of peacefulness. And I think that sense is very familiar to alcoholics, that they are waiting for that moment. And I found that over and over again with Tennessee Williams, with Hemingway, with Cheever, that they all have this sort of sense of escape, a desire to slip away from the cares of their lives. And alcohol is the key for them to do that. And it works very well in the early stages, but later on, it really doesn't work well at all. It causes much more trouble than it ever helps them.
And it was important for you to look, yes, at these six men and these six writers, but also to know that they were diagnosed alcoholics. They were alcoholics.
They were, absolutely, as opposed to people who sort of are hard drinkers but seem to manage it well. These were all people who really did suffer from alcoholism. I think they probably all would have admitted that, not always, but at certain points in their lives. And certainly the two who went through recovery, John Cheever and Raymond Carver, would say repeatedly, "I'm an alcoholic." John Berryman knew he was an alcoholic. Fitzgerald knew that he struggled with drinking. I think they all were aware that it was absolutely out of control in their lives, although somebody like Hemingway denies it for a very, very long time.
Right. And someone like Berryman seems like it's the most tragic of the stories.
And I think the reason it's so tragic is because his life absolutely falls apart. He behaves appallingly. He is estranged from children. He goes through marriage after marriage. It's not just that, though. It's that he tries to recover. He goes through these three great cycles of recovery. He goes into dry out. He has the whole 12-step process. And he just can't do it. And I think it's that sense of battle that we see in his life that makes it incredibly painful. And when he kills himself, it's just after he's come out of recovery. He's in the middle of writing this wonderful novel, which is also called Recovery, about a character just like him who is in the middle of drying out. And despite all of that, despite all the insight he pours into that book, he just can't quite manage to maintain sobriety. He can't tolerate the kind of agonizing depression that he suffers. and he ends up jumping off the bridge in St. Paul and killing himself, which is just an appalling waste, an appalling loss.
And this was a man who was tormented by his own father's suicide.
Absolutely. His father's suicide, his father killed himself, in fact, outside John's bedroom window when he was a small boy in Florida. And he wrote in one of his poems much, much later, "It blew out my brightest candle, faith." And I think that's really true, that it was a devastating experience for him. It was a devastating loss. It left him feeling very rudderless and very adrift. And I think that really was the heart of his feeling of bond with Hemingway, is that Hemingway's father also killed himself, not in childhood, when Hemingway was an adult. Mm. But nonetheless, a great blow to a man, I think, and something that makes it very... Hemingway wrote an awful lot about his father's suicide, both in his novels and in his own letters. And it was really something that he never could find himself in it to forgive or to understand. He found it absolutely devastating.
That idea that the words of that candle being blown out, it seems as though when you look at these writers, and you make this case very, very beautifully, that of how the alcoholism affects their writing, of what impact that has on them as not just individuals, and in the case of Berryman, a tragic story, as we mentioned, but on their writing and on their craft.
Mm, and I think that's the thing that really makes them have to realize their drinking has got out of control, is when they start to find that they're no longer writing as they were. And you see in Tennessee Williams in particular, who was an incredible diarist, he wrote a vast, vast volume of memoirs, of diaries and of memoirs. But in his diaries, he talks about how he is losing the ability to think clearly. He's losing the ability to structure. His writing's just dead on the page. He can feel it. It's confused. And he knows, he writes down, this is because of too much alcohol, but he can't quite find it in himself to stop. And when you look at Tennessee Williams' career, it really does show that there are these wonderful plays, Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, A Streetcar Named Desire, The Glass Menagerie, Night of the Iguana. And then he carries on writing. He has this incredible work ethic. He gets up every morning. He writes play after play after play, but he can't even get them performed by the end of his life. They're just not working at all. And he knows why that is, but he can't find it in himself to stop. And that sort of vicious circle of more and more rejections, more and more humiliations, having critics attack him over and over again, just contributes to the drinking. So you see how alcoholism becomes such a self-perpetuating system.
And this is the nature of the disease as well, but a writer like F. Scott Fitzgerald would say that the drinking helped in his creative flow, that it helped make the product better.
Fitzgerald will say all kinds of things. Sometimes he absolutely says that. Sometimes he says, my stories when I'm not drunk are boring. But other times he'll say things like, I bitterly regretted writing Tender as the Night, so much of Tender as the Night drunk. I can see that that wasn't a good idea. So it really depends on the moment that you catch him at. I think there's definitely ways in which an experience of drunkenness is transmitted into his novels, and it gives us that wonderful sort of slippery, intoxicated sense that you have in something like The Great Gatsby, that sort of almost jazzy drunkenness. There's blackouts, there's people falling over, that it moves the novel along. But when you look at something like Tender as the Night, which is obviously much more structurally damaged, it's got a lot of problems. And that seems to be about, you know, alcohol affects the brain, it affects the memory, it affects coherence, it affects the ability to structure. And I think you can see all of that in these late texts by all of these men.
Right. That loss of an ability to think clearly. It's something they
yeah.
all realize.
I think they all realized. I think it's impossible not to realize. And Hemingway, at the end of his life, not counting A Movable Feast, his later works are very bloated compared to that incredible clarity and cleanness that he manages as a young man. Some of that might just be the aging process, but some of it is clearly to do with the effects that alcohol has had on his brain.
And then there is how they, and you mentioned this with Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, but then there is the way that they write about drinking itself.
And that's so interesting, because they all write about alcoholics. They all have these sort of stories and preoccupations with alcoholics. So one of my favourite of Hemingway's books, For Whom the Bell Tolls, has a great deal about both the virtues of alcohol, how wonderful alcohol is, but it has a bad alcoholic, something that Hemingway was really fascinated by. And that bad alcoholic can't hold their drink. They can't... You can see them sort of falling into this precipice. I think they all found alcohol interesting. They all found it fascinating as a subject. They were aware that it has so much to do with the downfall of a character. It's useful for a novelist to be able to use something like that. And at the same time, I think it's personal as well. I think that they were just turning over their own experience, mining their own experience, but also trying to understand it, trying to get closer to it.
These are writers who would drink together.
Absolutely, yeah. So you see Hemingway and Fitzgerald rocking around the bars of Paris. And that's really interesting because Hemingway's account of it is very much, I could take my drink. That's Scott Fitzgerald. He absolutely couldn't take his drink, which is such a classic alcoholic's line. It's a way of sort of saying that's that other person over there is the alcoholic, not me, not at all. And then John Cheever and Raymond Carver used to do some drinking together when they were in Iowa City teaching at the university. They both used to spend an awful lot of time in the bar. And later in an interview in the Paris Review, Raymond Carver said that whole year, neither of us ever took the covers off our typewriters. All they were doing was drinking.
And we haven't talked a lot about Cheever in the course of our conversation, but his is an interesting case as well, because it even affected his public persona and his sexuality.
Yeah, it's the sexuality question is so interesting with Cheever. He was a married man, he had children, but his sexual desires were very much for men. His erotic life was about men. And he found that impossible to admit to himself. He found it a source of incredible shame. And it seems to me that the drinking was very much a way of trying to drown out those desires, drown out that man inside himself that he couldn't bear to be there, he couldn't bear to accept. And the story of John Cheever I find really very moving, very distressing, because it's so much a product of its times as well. If he'd been born 40 years later, I don't think that would have been his experience at all. That sort of toxic shame, inability to come out, is just terribly sad. And I think probably a reason that an awful lot of people fall into those kind of habits of drinking, those kind of habits of addiction, are because there's something about themselves that they find unbearable. And that to me really is a tragedy.
Still to come, Joe Donahue's conversation with author Olivia Lang continues with a look at how fame played a part in the lives of these men. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1237. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today is Olivia Lang, author of the new book, The Trip to Echo Spring, on writers and drinking, about the influence of alcohol in the lives of six extraordinary writers. She's speaking with The Best of Our Knowledge's Joe Donahue, who asked about the influence of fame on the lives and work of these men.
I don't think I looked at that enough, actually. That's something that is really starting to dawn on me now, that there are so many pressures that a writer's under, particularly somebody like Hemingway, who's very visible to critics, is often being really gunned down by critics, has to keep producing work, it's scrutinised very closely. There's enormous sort of pressure towards a public life. And this is somebody who's very shy, who suffers from a lot of social anxiety, despite the sort of big drinking, merry persona. He was inside that. He was really somebody who suffered a lot from anxiety. And I think those kind of pressures, alcohol could seem like such a release. It could seem like such a perfect drug. And you get Tennessee Williams talking about this, that he'll say, you know, a couple of glasses of Frascati, and it's like I've got different blood in my system. All the anxiety's gone away. I'm lifted up. And that works wonderfully for a while, but alcohol is addictive and it's a poison. So once you start becoming dependent on it, the second you stop, all that anxiety comes flooding back. You're in a much worse position than you were before. And so it goes on. This image of the vicious circle is just absolutely central, I think, to alcoholism. And fame really becomes a driver of that, because it's absolutely forcing writers to experience these feelings that they're already so afraid of, that it's creating more anxiety when that's something that they're desperately trying to avoid.
Was it a conscious decision not to include women?
It was a conscious decision, and I'm aware that there's a sort of shadow book that could be written about, say, Jean Rhys, Elizabeth Bishop, Marguerite Duras. I didn't want to do it because my experience as a child was with a female alcoholic, and it felt too close to home to me. It felt too painful. I didn't feel like I would have been able to approach it without bringing a lot of baggage. So I chose to focus on male writers. But I do hope somebody writes that book, because I think it'd be fascinating. And I think the thing with women drinkers is that it's much less socially sanctioned. It's much less glamorous. And that would make a really fascinating story.
You talk in the book about recovery from alcoholism being an act of faith, and the struggle that these men had with sobriety, that it was not always all it was cracked up to be for them.
Yeah, I wanted it to be. I wanted them to become perfect when they got sober.
Right.
And of course they don't. They're still who they are. So John Cheever, although he managed to sort of come to terms slightly more with his sexuality, from what I can gather, was in a fairly coercive relationship with a young man who didn't particularly want to be with him. Raymond Carver, although he had this sort of wonderful second life, produced all kinds of amazing poetry and short stories. He still seemingly had quite difficult relationships with his children and wrote in ways that I felt were really quite cruel about them, blaming them for his experiences during the periods of his drinking rather than really seeing them as the victims of his behaviour. I think the bottom line of it is that people, cliche as it sounds, people aren't perfect. Sober people aren't perfect. But that isn't to take away from the extraordinary courage of anybody managing to get sober. And the thing that really struck me was when Cheever was diagnosed with cancer and when he was told that he was going to die, all but one of his doctors said, John, you can carry on drinking, you know, start up again. Why not? Have some fun. And he said no. He wanted to die sober. He wanted to maintain the sobriety that meant so much to him in his later life. Mm. I think that's extraordinary.
There is also that, in reading the book and the stories that you tell, I mean, these guys could drink. I mean, you don't know how they stayed alive. It's amazing.
Yeah, they really can drink.
I mean, this is more than casual, even social, even college drinking. This is hardcore drinking.
And sometimes it's insane drinking, particularly when you look at Hemingway. The drinking is absolutely insane. There's a photo somewhere of him, and he's at a table, and it's covered in bottles, and he has this look. He looks like a man who's just been hit around the head. He looks bleary and confused, and it's a horrible photo. Or you have stories about F. Scott Fitzgerald in hotel rooms saying, I'm going into a toxic state, I'm going into a toxic state, but at the same time still drinking gin. He's got a sweater on. He's saying, I'm trying to sweat it out. But he hasn't stopped drinking. He's still pouring it in as fast as he's sweating it out. There's a madness about it. There really is a total madness about that kind of addiction. And the kind of constitution to withstand it. I mean, Hemingway must have been an extraordinarily tough physiological specimen, because he managed to keep going for much longer than most people do, but all of them experienced extreme physical consequences of their drinking and were hospitalized. All kinds of things happened to them because of what they were doing to their bodies.
Your study, of course, is very focused and looks at six writers and their addiction. But certainly much has been said and written about in the history of the arts, of artists in general, and addiction. And it's obviously a much larger canvas, isn't it?
It's a huge subject. It's a really huge subject. And I think you could equally write a book like this about visual art and be looking at people like Jackson Pollock and William de Kooning. There's all kinds of artistic scenes in which drinking has been both a motor, a sort of a social driver, a way for people to experience their creativity. But I think something that's really important is that this is a very 20th century story. There's definitely tales of drinking that come from the 19th century, but this particular mode of drinking, I think, is really about the 20th century. And I would be very surprised if a book like this was written about our own century. I don't think it will happen. I think we're much more puritanical. I don't think we have that sort of licentiousness anymore.
Puritanical and tolerant, right? I mean, I don't think publishers would tolerate it. I don't think even audiences would tolerate it, would they?
I think if you turned up at a reading now, absolutely out of your mind, drunk and vomited on the stage, people would be really unimpressed. I don't think they'd be humouring it in the way that they were then.
Well, and it, right.
Yeah. I'll try and tell you how it goes.
Well, I was going to say, there's a goal for your tour. Right? And not only that, but it would be on YouTube in 10 seconds.
Exactly. So the risks are much higher.
Do you read these gentlemen in a new way now?
My understanding of them deepened and deepened and deepened. And the thing that was really wonderful is that some of the things that I found were really depressing, were really unpleasant. But when I went back to the novels, with very few exceptions, they were as good as ever they were. In fact, sometimes even better, because the knowledge of the kind of wrecked lives that were behind those immaculate stories, those immaculate plays, made them seem all the stronger. I think that really was the sort of takeaway for me from the book, was the things they produced are astonishing.
Again, the name of Olivia Lang's new book is The Trip to Echo Spring, on writers and drinking. She spoke with the best of our knowledge's Joe Donahue. You know those times when you're laughing at an inappropriate time and someone says, "Hey, what's so funny?" Well, that's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. Is there a science behind humor? Peter McGraw, professor of marketing and psychology at the University of Colorado at Boulder, offers insights into what makes something funny.
What makes things humorous? The answer, benign violations. Something needs to threaten your sense of how things should be while also seeming safe, acceptable, or okay. Both babies and non-human primates such as apes and monkeys laugh when chased, tickled, or attacked in a safe and friendly way. As any slapstick comedian knows, physical threats like an assault with a banana cream pie similarly elicits laughter in adults. As humans evolved and developed culture, language, logic, and a sense of self, people experience threat and sometimes humorous reactions to a wider variety of situations. Thus, humor transcends physical gags to include violations related to social norms. Think fart jokes. Logic. Think absurdities. Communication norms. Think sarcasm. And identity. Think roasts. Of course, violations do not usually make people laugh. For a violation to be funny, it also needs to seem safe, acceptable, or okay. Many things make a violation benign. A playful state of mind, cues that a situation is safe or okay, feeling that a situation is far away, or low commitment to what is threatened. The theory also explains the two ways humor attempts can fail. Sometimes there's no violation. You can't tickle yourself because there's not a threat of attack. Other times there's nothing benign. You're not likely to laugh when tickled by a creepy stranger. Laughter only occurs when something is both wrong and okay.
That was Peter McGraw of the University of Colorado at Boulder. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. Thank you. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.